right, hello and welcome to Rewind, a podcast of 90s nostalgia. My name is Mike Chin. I'm one of your hosts here. I'm a writer and a professor of English. So it's really happy to be here. And I'm here with my friend Mike Scalise. So I'll let's say hello.
Hey there, Mike. Yes, my name is Mike Scalise. I'm an IT professional. I also work at a college and also happy to be here.
All right. Awesome. So we decided to record this podcast, not because the world necessarily needs another podcast, but what we were thinking about, just sort of stuff that entertains us. We're both people in our, I hope Mike doesn't mind me saying this, in our mid-30s. And so, we're in life where I think we can, appreciate nostalgia. We're not old yet necessarily, but at the same time, we do have some life experience behind us and kind of can remember the good old days. And we were friends from the good old days, right? Like we were, elementary school kids when we first started hanging out. And so a lot of our kind of formative years were hanging out together, and that includes most of the 90s. And so, we were both born in the 80s, but I know at least for myself, I identify kind of mostly as a child of the 90s in terms of like, that's the era when I was kind of aware of pop culture and where a lot of my favorite, movies and music and sports and then all kinds of other things come from. So, I don't know if there's anything you wanted to add about kind of what interested you about doing this podcast.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head, the same type of deal. I mean, even though we were born in the early 80s, even technically, but you're right. All the formative years were spent, throughout the 90s and, a little bit into the 00s. My childhood is defined by the 90s, and so many others, that are, within 3-5 years of our age. So there's just something, like you said, nostalgic and, that just brings you back and makes you feel good because it reminds you of your childhood. Again, it's just something that we wanted to, discuss. So,
yeah, no, I think that's great. Yeah. And, it's one of those things where I think sometimes people can kind of think that if you're, too focused on nostalgia or not talking about current events, you're burying your head in the sand. You don't want to talk about, the hard stuff going on right now. And I don't think that's really the case. Sort of, I think there's lots of people who can talk all about, COVID-19, all they want, and all about our current racial tensions in the U.S. And those are, I think, more important than anything we're going to talk about on this podcast. But this is something that we can talk about. This is something where, we lived it, we had our experiences, and you probably didn't have the exact same experiences as us, dear listener, but I expect you had your own kind of, similar, maybe overlapping kind of experiences, and maybe we'll bring you back a little bit as well. So speaking of going back, our first episode here, we decided we're going to talk about NBA basketball in the 1990s. This conversation might span a little bit earlier into the 80s, a little bit later into the 2000s, but we're going to focus, primarily on the 1990s. So let me just, start out by asking Mike, and I'll talk about my own kind of reflections on this, but, your own first memories of basketball in the 1990s.
Well, so, as we mentioned, we were born in the 80s. So in the 90s, I was probably, 8-10 years old when I really started to start dribbling a ball. And, my father had been, a big basketball player in high school and actually got a few full rides to colleges, kind of in the area. And so, growing up, I always had a basketball hoop in my driveway. And so, I actually think the very beginnings of my, involvement with basketball came from him. I think he, got me a basketball and we just started to play in the driveway a bit. And then, eventually you and I met, and realized we lived down the street from one another. So obviously we continued that whole thing. And my dad kind of took a back seat to us playing in my driveway.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's funny the way you framed that. Yeah. Cause I mean, that's how, I remember basketball is mostly being introduced by you and by, kind of our friendship. I think I had I think with people who don't know anything about basketball, which was me when I was kind of a kid that age, what would kind of assume is the ideal basketball body because I was tall and lanky and I could run quickly. But You know, I never really played basketball beyond like gym class or, you know, just kind of messing around with the ball. And so, you know, if I remember correctly, you know, you were even playing on a team that your dad was coaching, you know, just for like a year or whatever. And that was around the time when, you know, we started, you know, hanging out more and, you know, playing basketball ourselves more. And I remember you kind of teaching me the fundamentals of the game. You just like, even like how to shoot basketball, you don't shoot like two-handed, right? Like you really shooting with one hand, everyone's kind of guiding it, you know, things like that.
Well, the best I could. I mean, again, I was, you know, you had the body. I had not at all the body. I mean, I was actually quite short and a little bit stout for my age. But I had, you know, kind of secondhand from my dad or whatever. Or I don't know if that would be secondhand or firsthand. But I you know, I had what my dad had taught me to kind of go on. And I just, you know, shared that with you. So, yeah, I probably... probably tell you some of the fundamentals, but I can't call myself an expert.
Yeah. No, well, I mean, it's all relative, right? So, but you know, I mean, I don't think either one of us were great. You know, neither one of us, you know, went on to, you know, play ball or anything, but I think we had a lot of fun with it though. You know, that time, you know, in between us, you know, I know we had some, you know, your next door neighbors we played with sometimes. And I know eventually there was a playground those kind of, you know, down the street and kind of across the way from us that we would go to. We met some kind of eccentric characters there, but you know, it was an era in the 90s where, you know, kids could go out and play basketball. Like we could go out to a park, you know, once we were, you know, in our, you know, whatever it was, you know, like just pre-teenager or early teenager years, we could go and do that. You know, it's in a way that I don't know that I would send, you know, my son to do that when he reaches that age. Like I get a little nervous just thinking about it now, if, you know, who he'd run into at a park and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, sort of a more innocent time in some of those ways. But, you know, there are a lot of kids there. I mean, I remember we had all kinds of games and we would, you know, do pickup games and we'd play rock where it was kind of every man for himself. And I think you and I ended up teaming up a lot in those games, kind of, you know, under the surface and kind of, it's probably pretty obvious if anyone really paid attention to what we were doing, but I don't know, we had some really good times there, I think, though.
Yeah, I would agree.
But yeah, and, you know, it's funny, as I remember it, I think you were more into basketball earlier than I was. Again, I think, you know, between playing it and between watching it, I think you were a little bit more tuned into those early Bulls runs that we'll get to talking about a little bit here. But on top of that, I think the thing that really cinched it, that really kind of hooked me for good, was basketball cards. So, you know, baseball cards are kind of the stereotypical, you know, collectible that I think people tend to think of, you know, that were so big in kind of leading up to our generation. And I think that, you know, when we kind of, you know, came of age as, you know, again, kind of preteens and, you know, early teenagers, was kind of that boom of the trading card industry. Because now everyone knew, well, you know, save your card, like they'll one day they'll be worth money. And insert cards became kind of the big thing where, you know, there'd be cards that only appear on average one in every 5 packs or one in every 10 packs, or, you know, only one per box of 36 packs or, you know, whatever ratio, you know, it may have been. And they had these dollar amounts attached to them and all that. And I don't, do you remember how you first got into collecting cards?
You know, it's tough to say. I don't remember exactly, but what I remember is it's just how much fun it was to collect. And like, so that it was just, like you said, you know, I mean, the anticipation, you know, when you opened a deck of cards that you might get a really cool insert, and like you said, that's worth money. You know, my dad would always joke and say, okay, yeah, find somebody to pay you $55 for that piece of cardboard. But in the 90s, I mean, there were whole card shows at the mall,
right?
And they were pretty well attended, right? And so clearly there was some sort of collectible market for them. And again, I can't speak to like prior to that, but I imagine, you know, basketball cards have been around for a while. So, you know, like I said, clearly there was some market for them. You know, there was a social aspect to it too. Mm-hmm. We used to talk about, you know, what cards we got or just, you know, the whole idea of trading cards and figuring out, you know, what's a good deal on both person's ends. And so there was just, it was just like a whole kind of system. And, And you know, I like to think of myself, and I'm sure a lot of other people do, maybe you too, Mike, as a completist, you know, in that, you know, like right now I collect some rare whiskeys, and you know, I needed to get, you know, all the bottles of this one particular collection. And it took me a while, but I did. And in the same way, you know, basketball cards, you know, offer that opportunity too. You know, can you get the whole set of, you know, 93, 94 Upper Deck, or can you get, you know, all the inserts for, you know, for this one year, or for this one brand. I mean, it's just, there's just a lot of aspects to it, that, that are appealing, I think, to a lot of people, a lot of demographics.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And it's, you know, it's one of those things where I think I kind of went backwards. I think probably most kids were more into the sport, and then it's like, okay, cool, here's this cool thing I can collect related to it. I think the collectible aspect of it, and the idea that it was sort of a financial investment and kind of a game to kind of collect all these cards, like, I think that sort of, you know, again, hooked me on basketball to a large extent, because it was, you know, not only that, you know, I think, you know, Michael Jordan's a great basketball player, but it's like, well, I have this card that, you know, Beckett Basketball Monthly values at $4, and maybe if he wins another championship, it'll now be worth $6. And, you know, and I think, you know, my dad gave me a hard time about it too, where it's like, you know, the price guys can say whatever they want, but, you know, try finding an actual buyer for anything but the real rare, you know, really kind of premium cards. And you're mostly going to be out of luck, but yeah, well, and so to put a bow on this discussion of cards, I can picture this one card of yours that it was a Michael Jordan card, and I think you'll probably know immediately what I'm thinking about. I just wanted to raise this question, and I'll answer it myself as well afterwards, but of your favorite card, or, you know, if you had to, you know, pick a couple, that's fine too, but if you remember what your favorite card was from your collection.
Oh, that's really, really hard to say. I mean, there's so many good ones. Yes, the one you're talking about is a Michael Jordan card, and that probably is my favorite. It was actually, you know, to this day, I'm not sure I know the full story behind it, but it was a Topps, it was considered a Michael Jordan rookie card, but not really. It wasn't his official rookie card. It wasn't his extended rookie card, but it was this one that was put out by Topps, and it had, you know, his you know, quintessential dunk movement, and it had, you know, Bulls written kind of on the left-hand side vertically. And again, I always thought of it as like a wannabe real rookie card. It was a real card, but what I remember from it was Topps who put it out, and it also had his picture in the bottom left hand corner, and it was just a really cool card. I think I got it in one of the in a pack, so I, you know, it was something that, like, it's not like I shelled out a bunch of money for it, and it was just a really cool find. And of course it was Jordan, so I had to put it in one of those, you know, we had some serious cases back then,
right.
Probably still
screw
now, but
ones,
like,
right?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I only had a handful of those, but this was definitely deserving of the screw on cases. And I still have the card somewhere. It's just, and I can picture it. I just can't, I can't remember all the aspects of it, but I would say that was probably my favorite card. And just a little side story, one that I at one point traded away because I was naive, and you would, again, as a young man, you know, like, your priorities are different in life, and I really wanted it back. So I went through a few hoops, no pun intended, to kind of get that back, but yes, it's in my possession. It's in the screw case, and it probably holds a place in my heart as my favorite. But
yeah.
How about yourself?
Well, yeah, no. Well, it's funny because there are two cards that come to mind for me, and one has a lot of overlap with the one you're talking about. And I don't even know if you'll remember this card, because the funniest thing is I actually don't know for sure if I even have this card right now or not. I know for a period I didn't, and then I did again. It was, I just looked up, it's a 1996, 1997 Hoops card. It was an insert series called Head to Head. It was a Scottie Pippen and Michael Jordan card. And so, you know, that's obviously a duo of people. For everyone who collected cards in that era would be familiar, like Jordan cards were generally worth the most. And, you know, Pippen, you know, drew a, you know, it wasn't a common card. He, you know, drew some value himself. And so this insert card, I pulled it from a pack, and I think that that's part of the sentimental value is, you know, yeah, I didn't just kind of pay, you know, face value at a card show or a card shop for it, but rather, you know, luck of the draw. And it was a pretty, you know, rare one for not a premium series of cards, but, you know, an okay one. I think it was valued around like $30 or something in the price guides at the time. Yeah, which is kind of the luck of it. And the fact that it was, you know, a Jordan card just kind of come upon it, had that high dollar value. And I remember I traded it away too, just like you traded your favorite one. There was a guy I traded with in school who I traded this one because he had a bunch of really old cards. I think his family just kind of had cards from way back. He told me it was worth way more than it was. It turned out it was only worth a couple bucks, and so it was a huge ripoff on that trade. And I was pretty pissed at him afterwards. But you know, and it kind of taught me that similar lesson though. If you really love a card, it doesn't really matter, you know, the dollar value to dollar value. Just, you know, did you do what you actually think is right, if it's going to mean something to you. So I know I traded like a crap load of cards to get that one back. And I feel like I may have traded it again or may have eventually even sold it off or something for, you know, way less than, you know, the book value would have been. But regardless, that one always sticks out in my mind. But the other one I'll say, though, I said, you know, there were two of them. That's the one that came upon by the luck of the draw. And that's part of why I valued that one so much. The other one was a Patrick Ewing rookie card, the 1986, 80s, or was it 85, 86, or 86, 87? I forget what that famous year of Fleer basketball cards was. But regardless, it wasn't actually his rookie year, but there hadn't been officially licensed NBA cards for a few years. So that particular set has a whole bunch of rookie cards of guys like Jordan and Karl Malone and, you know, Patrick Ewing, Isaiah Thomas. And it's kind of, I think it was being kind of the grail of, you know, at least contemporary basketball cards, not going back to the ones from the 1940s or anything. But you know, you actually gifted that card to me, that Ewing rookie card. And so, you know, but both because Ewing was one of my favorite players, and we talk about being a completist. I was trying to collect all his cards for a while. I know I racked up over 200 of them. I still do have them somewhere, but I never really, you know, pay attention to it now. But that was kind of the crown jewel after I'd kind of stopped collecting in a serious way that, you know, kind of rounded out the collection for what it was. All right, so let's go ahead and switch gears and actually talk about basketball itself in the 90s and what I imagine some people might be more interested in. So for me, my kind of introduction to NBA and having any investment at all beyond what you would just kind of, you know, absorb through osmosis by, you know, Michael Jordan and, you know, Larry Bird being kind of famous at that time, what was the 93-94 New York Knicks run where they went to the NBA Finals. You know, and I think as I remember it, you and I, and I think a lot of people around us, kind of absorbed the Knicks as sort of being our own because they were the New York Knicks. It wasn't New York City Knicks or whatnot, so we could kind of claim them as a whole state. So, you know, even two kids who were growing up, you know, upstate, well away from Madison Square Garden, we could still kind of say they were our team. You know, I remember that team, and I guess I'm just curious, you know, of your early memories of that the Knicks around that era.
Yeah, I mean, I remember most of the players on the team. I remember, you know, watching the games with both my parents. I mean, it was a whole family affair. You know, I had the I didn't even know what you call it, like the trim in my room around the you know, around the top perimeter. They had all the Knicks, you know, the Knicks logo and everything. So remember, we had a mini bat. There was a mini basketball hoop in my room. So, you know, we were all about the Knicks. We were a Knicks family. But you're right, just despite being so far away from Madison Square Garden, it didn't matter. It was still our team.
Yeah, yeah. No, and it was kind of easy to take ownership over them, you know, and I think, you know, for me at least, you know, yeah, I hadn't really paid attention to, you know, NBA before that. And some of it was our friendship, you know, and playing. And I think this was a little before I actually started collecting. I think that was a couple years later, but that's when I really got into, you know, all of NBA basketball. But, you know, that particular run, it's just such a unique kind of team, kind of an underdog story almost, you know, because they were New York's, so we acclaimed them as our own. But they were kind of a scrappy team, you know, kind of, there wasn't the Michael Jordan kind of, you know, superstar, you know, kind of affiliated with them. Jordan had, you know, retired to baseball for a couple of years. And so that opened the window for them to be competitive and you go all the way to the NBA finals. Patrick Ewing, I mean, I think it is fair to call him a superstar, but he wasn't a star on the scale of, again, you know, the Jordan or Barkley or, you know, Magic Johnson or anyone like that. And there that other, you know, cast of kind of, you know, role players there and, you know, different degrees of stars. Did you have a favorite, Nick, around that time or someone who you kind of, you know, most identified with or anything like that?
Well, let me say this. I want to touch on what you were just talking about. You know, the way I would characterize the team is very similar to what you said, but, you know, it seemed to me that each person, obviously they have their own position, but they really, there wasn't somebody that was really great at all of them. And in fact, you know, you had, like Charles Oakley, who could hustle and rebound and everything like that. And Patrick Ewing was tall and he was a really good center, obviously, but not the best, not that I would call the best in the league. Right. And then, you know, I always liked Anthony Mason. I don't know that I could relate to him necessarily in the way that you were asking me, but he couldn't shoot a free throw for anything, you know?
Remember he would shoot like with one hand stuck out to the side and like, yeah.
Yes. But nobody else had a cool hairstyle like him.
That's,
you know,
true.
Like
that's
he could have, you know, so, you know, it's like they all had their own thing, like, and you couldn't take that away from them, but like, in some sense, that was it. But as long as they each excelled at their one thing collectively, this is why I really like them as a team. It's not that one person, and this goes back to kind of what you were saying. There wasn't just one huge superstar that like carried the whole team necessarily. I feel like they all just meshed well together, which made them such a unique, I don't know about unique, but it made them such an entertaining thing to watch. But in terms of like, did I have a favorite player? I mean, so I had to love Patrick Ewing because my mother was in love with Patrick Ewing and he winked at her once. So, you know, for that reason, I have to say Patrick Ewing in case my mother ever listens to this. But outside of that, I kind of liked Allen Houston a lot. I don't know why. I just thought he was just a solid player I don't know. I always thought he had a really good shot and was pretty versatile. Again, I was saying earlier that each person kind of played their own position, but in terms of versatility, I mean, he could do a lot for the team, I thought.
No, I mean, I think in that late 90s version, so you know, there's, I think of there's being two kind of eras of 1990s Knicks, and there were certainly overlapping players. I think, you know, for that late 90s version of them, Allen Houston was kind of the guy, right? I mean, Patrick Ewing may have still been the bigger star, but, you know, Houston, I think, was you know, carrying the load on scoring. You know, he was a great shooter. You know, I think people have questions about his, like, hustle or his defense, but, that's also subjective. And, you know, I think he had kind of the misfortune of looking like he was always kind of calm and cool, and so people assume that that's how he was. And I'm not sure if that's actually, you know, what was really going on in his head at the time. Though on the opposite end of that spectrum, though, the one name that didn't come up that I thought would have, though maybe I just kind of put this on you.
John Starks.
Yeah, John Starks. Yeah.
John Starks, yeah.
John Starks.
Ah, Starks. He is, he's awesome. I mean, there's no question about that. And actually, to be honest, that it kind of slipped my mind. Number three, and you know, I don't know his exact height, but, you know, generally speaking, relative to a lot of the other players in the NBA, he was, you know, he was on the shorter end, right? I mean,
right.
He's a guard. And so, you know, and I'll never forget that dunk over Pippen and Jordan.
Yeah.
And he was a good shooter and everything like that. But the thing with Starks is, again, love him, but he, you know, you had to wonder, in any given game, is he going to be hot or is he going to be cold?
Yeah.
You're right. You, a lot of times you didn't see a lot of just like kind of consistent, solid play. It was, you know, when he was hot, he was really hot. When he was cold, he couldn't drain anything. So, I guess he would be if not first, he'd be a close second for sure.
Yeah, well, and that goes to, so in 1994, Jordan again is off playing baseball. The Knicks actually win their way to the NBA Finals. They had not won a championship since 1973. And spoiler alert, they still have not won a championship since 1973. But they take the Houston Rockets to seven games. I don't know how conscious of this I was at the time, but I think on paper the Rockets were kind of the favorites. I think that, you know, that they looked like the stronger team. Heads up, Olajuwon to Ewing. I think Hakeem Olajuwon was the better NBA player. I think, you know, Ewing in college got the better of him, but, you know, by that point, you know, Olajuwon was a better player. I think he had a slightly better supporting cast at that time, at least, again, you know, more objectively speaking, that I didn't like them as much, but, you know, I think just if you're going to go, you know, just pure talent. They go all the way to game seven, and John Starks is kind of a featured player in that game. And I don't know the exact stat, but I think he goes something like 2 for 27 from the field, only makes two of those shots. It's one of those things, if you reverse that ratio, or 25 or 27 would be an incredible shooting night, but say he made 15 of those shots, so a little bit more than half. I think Knicks win. I think the Knicks were NBA champions. Like you said, he was very, kind of streaky in that way. Passionate as heck, right? He was always kind of fired up. I think he kind of embodied New York in that way. Was not kind of the reliable kind of consistent guy the way that Allen Houston, Moore was, I think, in that later 90s run. I kind of look at it as being there are those two, kind of big runs the Knicks had, the two times they made the finals. I think the second one was technically in 2000. It was that abbreviated season where they had the lockout that, cut off half the season. But the Knicks, they accumulated all this talent, because they still had Patrick Ewing. I want to say Starks was still with the team, or maybe he had just left the team at that point. But they had Larry Johnson all of a sudden. Allen Houston had been there for a couple years. Latrell Sprewell, who'd come off that controversy where he was choking his coach, PJ Carlissimo, which I think is still kind of a controversial thing, what actually happened there. They all of a sudden had a lot of talent. I think, at least again, on paper, more talent than they'd ever had. But they didn't really gel right away. As I recall, and I might be, slightly off on some of this, but, when they went into the playoffs, they were the bottom seed of the East. And I think they were actually the bottom seed, of the whole, of the 16 teams that made the playoffs, they were the lowest, win-loss ratio team still in the game. And they end up, beating the Miami Heat in round one, which in and of itself was awesome, because if you're a New York Knicks fan, you hated the Miami Heat in that area. That rivalry was just kind of all over the place with suspensions and fights and everything. They beat the Heat. I think they beat the Hawks next, and they beat the Pacers, who are also longstanding rivals, and get all the way to the finals there. But along the way there, I'm pretty sure this was a game with the Pacers. I bet you remember this too. We were watching this game together. I remember being in your room back in your house you grew up in when Larry Johnson hits that 4-point play.
Yep.
Do you remember what I'm talking about there?
Oh yeah, I do. I do. First of all, going back to the whole seventh, they were the seventh seed and made it to the final. Like that was record setting, by the way.
Right, right.
That I don't think that had ever happened before.
I'm pretty sure that's right. Yeah.
So, what a record for the Knicks to have. I mean, in a way, it's like you're the worst team, but you were able to claw your way back and make it to the finals. So, and this year, just for a second, this year, like the last time they had made the finals, I considered both, even though they didn't win either time, I considered it a win because, in the Eastern Conference Finals, I mean, in both cases, they beat the Pacers and I believe so. And that's right. To me, I've already won. And then the finals would have been, gravy, but I do remember that 4-point play, from Larry Johnson. And, it was right towards the end of the, I don't know if it was a buzzer beater, but the Knicks were down. They needed 4 points.
Yeah. I think that they were down. I think they were down three.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, But yes, yeah, so I remember he got fouled, and I mean, it's like you can Google Larry Johnson 4-point play.
Yeah.
No, you could start typing Larry Johnson in Google, and it will auto complete it to something like Larry Johnson 4-point play. It was a real defining moment in his career, I think. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's a super rarity that you see that these days, and to have it happen at such a crucial time in a game. Back then it was just, yeah, I mean, I remember just yelling and screaming at the TV, like, oh, right. My God, yes.
Right, right. Nah, and, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you alluded to, you kind of considered a win because they beat the Pacers in the conference finals. And, like, you know, if you ask a hardcore, you know, Knicks fan of that era, like, I would consider us to be, you know, would you rather win the championship or have beaten the Pacers in the playoffs? I think they would probably wait for a minute and try to decide. So I think that it was so sweet, just kind of shutting up Reggie Miller and all of them.
Yeah. Right.
So yeah. You know, and again, you kind of hit the nail on the head that, you know, he gets fouled shooting a 3-point shot, you know, at that kind of pivotal, you know, juncture of the game, you know, makes the shot, makes the free throw to follow, and they win the game. And, you know, I don't think that was the decisive game. That was the game before the decisive game, but still was so pivotal in shifting the momentum of things and kind of, you know, setting them up to, you know, go all the way to the finals. And they got crushed in the finals, right? There's no two ways around it. I think they won one game in that series against the Spurs, but they were just outgunned at that point. This was Tim Duncan kind of his first or second season in the NBA, but his first time in the finals, regardless. And, you know, the end of David Robinson's run, you know, in between them and the cast of supporting players, I think Ginobili and all them were on the team at that point. It was just too much for the Knicks. They were just kind of overwhelmed, you know, at that point. But like you said, it still felt like a victory in its own way. Like, I would have loved to have seen them, you know, get the championship, but you still to have gotten that far and to have those moments along the way, it's hard to top that.
Right.
But yeah, well, so, you know, the other team, though, I think when you talk about 90s basketball, and, you know, especially if you're not someone who, you know, grew up in New York, you know, kind of the team, what was the Bulls, right? So they have, you know, two distinct, you know, three-peats where they win three championships in a row. The first one was in the early 90s. It would have been 91, 92, 93 when they won those finals. And again, that was before I was really paying attention. So Michael Jordan was probably, you know, he had to be in like the top five most famous people in the world at that point. So you couldn't be completely oblivious that was happening. You know, you would know the name, you know, Scottie Pippen. But I wasn't really, you know, watching basketball at that point. I kind of missed that era of it. So I want to drill more into the late 90s teams, but anything you would want to say, I think you were probably paying a little bit more attention than I was. Anything you'd want to say about those early 90s Bulls?
I mean, just that they were, you know, it's like when people, you know, follow a sport because, or follow a certain team in a sport because they're the winning team. I mean, that was the winning team for basketball. Yeah. So how I imagine like Lakers and Celtics were from even before us, nice, watching basketball. But you know, if you attached yourself to that team and didn't give a crap about what your like home team was, yeah, like that was entertaining because you could kind of be sure that your team was going to make it pretty far. Right. You know, it's easy to latch onto a team that's already winning. And it was entertaining to watch them. And I mean, I'm more of a Knicks fan, but I was for sure a Bulls fan too. I remember having a red and black basketball that had a Bulls logo on it for a little while too. But obviously, you know, as I got a little bit older and as I followed it a little bit more, I had to be true to my New York Knicks. But but it was for sure fun to watch the Bulls. I mean, throughout the 90s. It was just really, really great to see so many great players coming together.
Yeah, well, and that's where, you know, again, I kind of want to pivot because I think, you know, those early 90s teams, I've done a fair amount of, you know, reading about NBA and, you know, full disclosure to everyone listening to the podcast, I hope Mike doesn't mind me saying this, but neither of us have watched The Last Dance yet. And so I know it's high on both of our list of things we want to watch. I'm waiting for it to go on Netflix. And at the time of this recording, it has not yet done that. So, you know, I know we might be missing some pieces there, but regardless, I think, you know, we lived it though. So I think we can still speak with some authority about what it was like to watch the Bulls in these eras. So again, I've read about those early 90s Bulls. I read the Jordan Rules, which is a pretty famous book by Sam Smith, for those who haven't experienced it, where it talks about that season where they kind of broke through and won their first championship. And, you know, I think Jordan emerging as definitively the greatest player of his generation, if not of all time. You know, I think that's, a story in of itself. But that from 1995 to 1998, that's a whole separate run for them. Because Jordan, again, he left to play baseball. He comes back. And Scottie Pippen is still there. And I think if anything, it's just a little bit more experience. He's been the leader of that team for better or for worse for a couple of years. But, you know, is a great player in his own right. And then there's this other assemblage of talent around them. So you have Dennis Rodman, who's probably the most famous, you know, third guy there. And is probably the only famous, well, not the only, but one of the few really famous NBA players who was not a scorer. Right. I think if you ask people to name, you know, NBA players, they know if they're relatively casual basketball fans or not basketball fans at all. Pretty much everyone they'll name is going to be a guy who at least scored like, you know, 20 points a game or so. Right. Rodman never did that. He wasn't a scorer. He rebounded insanely. That was kind of his calling card, was he would average in the high teens, if not, you know, up to 20 rebounds a game, which was, you know, just pretty nuts for anyone. And he wasn't super tall either, right? And he just kind of had a sense for it almost. He describes it in his book as being almost an instinct for where the ball was going to go. He just kind of could read it. But, you know, so you have Rodman on that team. And then you have just all these other role players. Like there's Ron Harper, who was kind of a bust. Like a lot of people were billing him as one of the next Michael Jordan candidates. That wasn't who he was. You know, he averaged like 20 points a game for the Clippers for a couple of years, moved over to the Bulls, and settled into this role as Michael Jordan's point guard. He was a guy who could bring the ball up competently, and feed it to Jordan. He kind of had his role and knew it and did it really well. You had Steve Kerr, who came off the bench most of the time, but one of the great 3-point shooters of his generation. You know, won 3-point shooting contest at the All-Star weekend. And there was Tony Kukoc, who was always kind of in my mind, kind of the ideal of an NBA sixth man. See, he came off the bench. He could play literally every position because like he was 6'11", so he could viably play center. He was big enough, but he could handle the ball too. He could play point guard. A lot of times actually moved him into that point guard role. Just to have all of these pieces, like you have like the best player in the league, Michael Jordan. You have probably the best supporting man in Scottie Pippen, the best rebounder in Dennis Rodman, the best 3-point shooter in Steve Kerr, the best sixth man in Tony Kukoc, and a bunch of other guys who played their roles well. And Phil Jackson is kind of a great coach. And so, but before I prattle on about how much I love the 95 to 98 Chicago Bulls, Mike, what do you remember about that team, or what kind of stood out to you there?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. I was going to say that it's that, you know, every player on the court had something that they actually, you know, really excelled at. I mean, and the Bulls, unlike the Knicks, you know, I said before with the Knicks, like, you know, everybody had kind of their thing, right? But that was what they were really good at, and then everything else was kind of not great, you know. Right. But with the Bulls, everybody had their thing. Like you said, Rodman's great rebounder. He's an animal. You had Kerr with his 3-point accuracy. But they were also, really good, like good at the other components, at the other aspects of the game. They weren't great at them. They were great at their one thing, but they were really good at all the other things. So even when Steve Kerr wasn't shooting the ball, he could handle the ball pretty well. Mm-hmm. Tony Kukoc, like you said, super versatile, great six man, could play virtually any position. Same with Jordan. You know, Pippen again, super versatile. And so it's almost like they're just that next kind of level up where they excel at their strengths, but their weaknesses are just few and far between. So they kind of just set the bar that much higher for all the other teams, and it shows. You saw, and interestingly enough, you have somebody like Jordan who's kind of like clearly the leader on the team, and to some extent, Pippen too, as a supporting player, you know, is driving the team. Yet they work so well as a team.
Right.
So they kind of hit it on all angles. It's like, you don't have somebody that's like the one star of the team. You have the star of the team, but then also everybody else that works really, really well together, that's really good at what they do. And there's just, I guess the way to say it is that their weaknesses were just so few and far between that it only left them to be great.
I think you're exactly right on that. And, and it's one of those things where, you know, behind the scenes, I think that there were a lot of issues, especially towards the very end. And again, we haven't watched The Last Dance. I've done a fair amount of reading, and I'm sure that Mike has just, you know, heard the stories too. But like, you know, Jordan is kind of notorious for not being the nicest guy behind the scenes. So, you know, I'm sure there was some drama there. I know there was a time he physically, you know, beat up Steve Kerr in a practice. Like, he punched him in the face and like bled his nose and like, so, you know, there were those kinds of wrinkles. And Scottie Pippen, I know there was a lot of drama there because he was drastically underpaid in that era. Like Jordan was making somewhere in the ballpark like $30 million a year before endorsements. Pippen was making like $2 million, which, you know, for you and me, $2 million, great. I'll take that any day of the week. But for a player of his caliber in that era and a team that was as successful as they were was sort of a slap in the face, I think. He was in a long-term contract and it was sort of stuck. I think that, you know, Mike, you're exactly right that just in terms of, you know, team chemistry, ability to play, I think Phil Jackson as a coach was instrumental in this, but just kind of, you know, bringing those guys together. I really wonder, I think it's one of the great unanswerable questions, is, you know, could they have won a fourth championship? In either one of those runs, did Jordan not gone to baseball, or if Jordan hadn't retired in 98, the same time that Phil Jackson left the organization? I think Rodman left at that point as well. Pippen, I forget if he may have had one more season there, but he went to the some other teams and, you know, played for a while. I do wonder, and you know, you don't have to answer this, but you might be just in the same place as me. Like, I don't know if they could have won another, but man, for those two sets of three seasons, and especially that last set, it's tough to beat the Bulls.
Yeah.
Though I will say the one wrinkle now is, in 95-96, they won 72 games. Which was the record, and that was a long-standing record, until the Golden State Warriors came around and won 73 games. This isn't a basketball podcast, you know, purely speaking. We're not just going to go into contemporary basketball too much. I'll say I actually kind of relished in the fact that they did not win the championship that year. They lost in the finals to the Cleveland Cavs. LeBron James kind of just would not lose that year. I sort of appreciate that they didn't win it, because I think it leaves kind of that open door of like, no, that Bulls team was the greatest of all time. You can't say the Warriors were better. I think some people will argue some of those 80s Celtics teams were even better. And I don't know enough about it to have a firm opinion on that. But to me, the at least the 95-96 Bulls, I think will stand the test of time as the greatest NBA team of all time.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with that, and I think it will too, and I hope it will, because it was such a big part of our childhood that, you know, it'll be nice to kind of, you know, say that we took part in that, in that greatness in some sense.
Yeah. Well, hey, so speaking of greatest teams of all time, the Dream Team, the original Dream Team, 1992 Olympics. We don't have to talk a lot about them. I just wanted to touch on them because I feel like any conversation of 1990s basketball wouldn't be quite complete without that discussion. So to lay the groundwork, for the first time, the men's Olympic team does not win the gold medal in the preceding Olympics. So they say, okay, to heck with it. We're going to just have these professionals declare amateur status and let them play in the Olympics. So all of a sudden you have kind of the most star-studded team of all time, certainly at that point, if not ever, assembled for this purpose. So, Larry Bird, who's at the very tail end of his NBA career, has won at the collegiate level, won multiple NBA championships. All of a sudden he's considered an amateur and can play in the Olympics. And is teamed up with Magic Johnson and Michael Jordan, Clyde Drexler, even Carmelo, John Stockton, Charles Barkley, kind of a who's who. I mean, there are a couple notable exceptions, but, just sort of the very best of the NBA. Adding Christian Laettner, who I think was still a collegiate player or just coming out of his collegiate career. But, I think there's one or two guys like that. But on the whole, just kind of the best of the best from the NBA. Any memories of the Dream Team from your end or any thoughts on that?
You know, and that's where I think that I think the Dream Team had just, like, I think it was a couple of years after that that really my memories of basketball and specifically the NBA really start. So I heard a lot of stories from my dad, and I've done some reading about the Dream Team, and I know that they I've looked at some of the final scores and how they literally they crushed the competition. And again, unsurprisingly, like you said, all the names you listed, that was a team of who's who, you know. So but unfortunately, I would have loved to remember and to have seen them play in 92, but I think that was a little bit before I really got deep into the NBA.
Fair enough.
Those players. Enough. Yeah.
Yeah, but, it's one of those where we look back at the lineup. Because, I think, some of the guys, specifically, Bird and Magic, I think were kind of, past their prime. Like, if you could have gotten the versions of them from, 5 years earlier, that team would win games by, 30, 40 points, I think. But get those guys in their absolute prime and say, just win by as much as you can. I think we would have seen, 75-point win margins, if we would have gotten that. So, definitely some guys who weren't quite there. Isaiah Thomas was notably left off the team. I know they talk about that in The Last Dance. I don't know, the full stories there, but my understanding is it was kind of political that at least Jordan and I think some other people on the team as well didn't want him on the team, despite kind of being the more obvious choice than a John Stockton or than some of the other guys who were kind of in more supporting roles. Kind of could have interchanged some people, but they just didn't really want to play with him. So it's sort of interesting there. But yeah, definitely just looking at the names on that lineup, hard to imagine a much stronger team. I wanted to briefly touch upon. I feel like any conversation of basketball in the 90s wouldn't be complete if we didn't at least briefly address NBA Jam, right? So this is a game that. You introduced it to me, right? Because all my memories, from really going, we're playing in your bedroom. You had the Super Nintendo. I was kind of just getting into basketball, I think, when we started to play that game. And I eventually got my own copy of it. I played a lot by myself as well. But what do you remember about NBA Jam?
Oh, God. I remember everything about NBA Jam because I feel like, I had a Super Nintendo and to this day, it's still my favorite system. I mean, 16-bit, so what? That was good enough for me. And I think there were, I want to say there were 29 teams, something like that in to choose from. And, I was always the Knicks, Starks and Ewing, because the game was really interesting because you had a lot of games in that time frame that tried to replicate what you see on the court. In that, 5-on-5. And mm-hmm. frankly, at 16-bit and given the size of TVs and just where video games were, it didn't make sense. It was too hard to follow all the people on the court. So for whatever reason, I think it was Acclaim that made NBA Jam. Mm-hmm. They thought, we're just going to have two people per team play on the court. And it was mm-hmm. a lot easier to follow. You could play with your friends and you could have 2-on-2 and it was just, it was enough and it worked well, I think. They had all the cheat codes to, give yourself, turbo forever and, put your, make yourself on fire. So you had a higher likelihood of draining shots and things like that. So, and even you could dunk and break the backboard. I mean, they really folded in quite a few features. And it was like, how do we want it to work? Not, okay, here's how it works in real life. Let's make it into a video game. And so they really, like I said, they really kind of reimagined the whole idea of basketball and put it into this game. And you and I had played for, hours and hours, days in and days out. I just remember, I remember the announcer, he's heating up and he's on fire. And I remember just playing each other all the time. We'd block each other's shots. It was just a really great kind of supplement to watching basketball, like being able to kind of play it and play with our team. How about you? What would you say about it?
Yeah, you know, because it's one of the things where I don't think either one of us, you know, really followed video games enough after that to have a definitive opinion on, you know, where basketball video games went afterwards. But I did just find it so playable, right? You know, and I think about, but like I remember after we started to kind of get into it, I remember I bought a copy of Bulls versus Blazers, which was a kind of competing game at the time, and brought it home and I hated it. Like it just wasn't fun because it was that 5-on-5 structure and it was just impossible to follow kind of who had the ball at a given time or you know, who I was controlling at a given time. And I feel like NBA Jam was kind of the ideal game for someone who was sort of casually into basketball. And that's not to say that we weren't, you know, serious about our basketball, but I think you know, if you just wanted, you know, kind of the biggest stars, okay, here's the two biggest stars from each of the teams. So that's all you really need. You just need two players on the court from each team to be able to pass the ball back and forth. That's as much as you kind of need for not to do the one-on-one game. Yeah, and then all the theatrics of kind of, you know, dunking and, you know, breaking the backboard and being on fire and all that. You know, and it's one of those things, I don't know what games do now. I don't know if this is still a thing, but there was that kind of computer assistance thing where if, you know, you're playing single player and you're winning by too much, it would start kind of having you miss shots. You're just doing the exact same thing as you were doing before, but it wouldn't work as well. And it may have been when we were two player as well, but I remember that, you know, when we were both playing and we both had some experience with the game under our belts, we would kind of crush the computer. Like, I mean, it wasn't even close, you know, like we could up the score and score 20 before they got a single basket in. But I remember that, like you said, we started to kind of play against each other despite being on the same team, right? So yeah. I think sort of, you know, informally it was sort of like, well, who can score the most points? So I'm going to block your shot and steal the rebound and put it in myself, that kind of thing. You know, which is, it's just kind of silly. I think more than anything, it was just kind of fun to kind of antagonize each other. And it was kind of funny to, like, you know, like shoot like the perfect shot that was clearly going to go in and then catch it out of the air.
I'm to tell you the truth, I'm a little bit surprised but happy that they built that in. Like, yeah, they built in the ability to block your own teammate.
Right.
And so it's just like, I mean, I work in IT. I mean, you don't have to be an IT person to know that, but like that had to be built in. It wasn't just like, oh, yeah, we're going to enable blocking and like, oh, if it happens to be your own teammate, so be it. No, like they had to say, hey, it's okay to, you know, to not call this goaltending or whatever and just allow blocking of your own teammate. And so, yeah, we used to do that to one another constantly. And the other thing, let me just say this too. All the annoyances of, I mean, that's kind of a self-imposed annoyance with trying to block your teammate or whatever, but all the annoyances of, and I didn't play Bulls versus Blazers, but I would imagine that, things like that, that you might find in a game, they removed. So like you can't go out of bounds, I don't think.
Bounds
in NBA Jam. And like, because who wants to play where, you know, you're running up the court and you go over a little bit too much and now you're out of bounds and then you have to throw on the ball again and all that. And, you know, yeah. So they kind of kept it at like, what's the important piece to casual players, like you were saying, or casual followers of the NBA. I feel like they really hit the nail on the head for the time.
Yeah. I think you're right about that. And it moves too, right? Because I'll say one of the things that, you know, I have a hard time sitting through, which is kind of any old basketball these days. You know, maybe if it's like a championship game, I can kind of get into it or, you know, some particular story I'm kind of invested in. But so all the fouls, all the timeouts, you know, because, I mean, it's
right.
Whatever. It's like 48 minutes of regulation, but it's like impossible to watch a game for less than like 2.5-3 hours, right? It's like it doesn't compute there. But in NBA Jam, there's no fouls even. Right. So there's never, like, okay, you hit somebody the wrong way, so that they're going to shoot free throws. It just keeps going. Right. And they had goaltending. I think that's the only kind of, you know, foul related thing that they really had in the game. And it's just continuous play based on that.
So, right. Yeah. Right. Three minute quarters, I think.
Yeah. I think that's right. Yeah.
So you could finish a game in, you know, 12 to 15 minutes by the time everything's said and done. Yeah. They had a little halftime thing with Horace Grant and dunking the ball and, we always, you know, like we thought that was the best graphics, you know, that we would see. It's, you know, in 16-bit. Now it probably looks like actually Horace Grant dunking.
It probably like actual video footage they embed now.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. but yeah. I mean, all the things you said. I mean, it just. And again, maybe we're a little biased. I don't know. because it was, you know, maybe we look past some of its shortcomings, but it's, I'm hard pressed to think back and find things I really don't like about it.
Nah, you know, and the only two knocks I'll place on the game, just as a matter of timing, I think there were some rights issues as well. No Michael Jordan, no Shaquille O'Neal. I think those are the two obvious omissions from that era where it was just didn't quite sync up to be able to include them in the game that were kind of obvious picks, right? Because it's you know, Scottie Pippen and Horace Grant, and then I think it's, I don't know, is it maybe Nick Anderson and Dennis Scott, somebody like that? For
no, Ron Harper is one of them.
Oh, is he? Okay, yeah. So I thought it was the Clippers then. But regardless, though, I mean, like, you take any
maybe.
Shaq is clearly kind of the pick for the Magic at that point. Anyway, but, you know, great game, great memories from that. I just want to hit a couple other high notes before we go to our kind of closing couple segments here. So in terms of other just noteworthy kind of memories, players, Kobe Bryant. So he starts playing, I think it's 96 or 97 is his rookie year. So you know, tail end of the 90s, and I kind of think of myself as, you know, just starting to kind of phase out when he's starting to kind of hit his stride, because his first season he comes off the bench, he's not even a starting player, and yet still has such kind of high hopes around him. Like, everyone kind of has earmarked him already, he's going to be a star, he's in that next Michael Jordan conversation, and I think is one of the few guys who kind of are given that tag who actually, you know, come close to it. I don't think he ever, you know, quite reached that mark of greatness. But, you know, tough to deny that he was a great player. We don't have to go, you know, really in-depth on it, but any thoughts on Kobe?
You know, I'll tell you, I always felt he was a very solid player. Again, he has that kind of body type that can play a lot of positions. He's always just been very, just very athletic, very, you know, he had a 75-point game? Or 80-point game?
It was so absurd. I think it was like 70 points, yeah.
Well, so, but the thing is that that alone, a non-star doesn't score that many points in a game, you know?
81 so like, points.
That's a cool 81 point. Points, yeah. So that's just it. So you're dealing with somebody who's clearly good at their craft, mm-hmm. you know? And so now one of my earliest memories of Kobe was the dunk contest where he did a between the legs dunk. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so again, a scorer, a dunker, you know, I thought he made a really good teammate too. I mean, again, I didn't really, he was always a star as far as in my book, as far as the NBA goes, but I never followed him, you know, like religiously, but I, you know, again, personal matters aside and, you know, his own life there. But from an NBA perspective, I really think that he was again, maybe not Jordan caliber, but getting up there for sure.
Yeah. You know, and it's one of those things where, he always kind of stuck in my craw. I think two things about him. One, there were the sexual assault allegations early in his career, which I sort of feel like if that happened now, that probably would have been a much bigger deal. And probably that may have kind of tainted his legacy permanently in a way that always made me a little uncomfortable. I'm just not sure what to kind of make of that aspect of kind of, you know, his life and career. But then the other piece, you know, more to the point of the basketball discussion, as I think you wisely kind of recentered us, you know, I think he thought he was great and he kind of placed himself in that conversation of greatest of all time, which in a way, I don't know if he would have been as good if he hadn't done that. Because definitely confidence wasn't his issue. He definitely saw himself as, you know, someone who belongs on that, you know, Mount Rushmore of your greatest players. And I just didn't feel like he belonged there. And so I think because he said he was there, that almost pushed me in the opposite direction of like, oh, you think you're one of like the top five ever? Well, now I don't think you're the top 10 at best ever. Now I think you're like, you know, bottom 20 or, you know, I think just kind of being contrary about it, and, you know, not liking him. But, you know, but I think more objectively speaking, he was a great player. I mean, I think he definitely does belong in that conversation of, you know, I think to be fair, probably top 10 or so players in NBA history. But just a couple of high notes. So you mentioned the dunk contest because I actually that had slipped my mind, but you're absolutely right that he did win the dunk contest that year and he did the between the legs dunk. I wanted to mention Vince Carter in this discussion as well because, you know, I think it was 98. I think it was his rookie year. You know, he wins the dunk contest and does it in spectacular fashion, right? Just does kind of these really creative dunks, these really athletic dunks, the stuff that at least I had never really seen anything quite like before. You know, and it's kind of his coming out party. And it has this absurdly long career. We're recording this June 25th, 2020. And I don't know if you saw this headline, but today he announced his retirement. So you we're talking back, you know, in the, you know, mid late 90s, he was still playing up until the COVID-19 thing. I wonder if it's because he's technically a senior citizen now that he doesn't want to play other players anymore for risk of getting COVID. He never won a championship. You know, he was never kind of like the guy, like the top star in the league, but a long legacy. And especially the, you know, again, that late 90s when he was kind of just pulling these dunks, you know, out of his rear end. Like he was just kind of incredible to watch.
Well, you know, here's the thing. So if you're not going to win, I think most people aren't going to win a championship, right? Yeah, right? I mean, that's, and especially if you have teams like the Bulls where it's like the same people winning over and over and over, right? Kind of hogging it, but no, but deserving. And so if you're not going to win a championship, I feel like the next best thing is to be known for something good.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so, so you're right. I mean, he pulled out some dunks that were just, which, by the way, let me just take a second here. I had not seen that he just announced his retirement. Like, this is Robert Parrish level, probably.
He's right there with him, yeah.
So crazy. But anyway, so, yeah, he had some wild dunks. I had the pleasure of actually seeing him dunk in person when I went to a Raptors-Knicks game, of course. Back in the day, but yeah, I mean, again, with the dunk contest, I mean, he had, you know, you see these 360 degree dunks. He's like, no, I'm going to up it to the next, you know, turn or quarter turn. Or, I mean, it's just, you know, between the legs and it's just, so if, you know, if his claims to fame are, you know, an amazing dunker, one of the best dunkers, but that's it. I mean, it's something, you know, of that and longevity in the league, I suppose. He might be reaching, trying for that too, which I don't know. I don't know if I characterize that as a good or a bad thing, but
minimum salary, $500,000. I think for the NBA, okay. Played it for 20 plus years. Like, what the heck, do it.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So in a few respects, you know, I have to give it to him a little bit, but I can't speak to whether I don't know that I'd put him at, you mentioned him in the context of the Kobe discussion.
Sure.
You know, like, I don't know how I can, it's not like he was ever on a championship team or was, you know.
Yeah. No, I don't think he ever played with a team that was really gunning for a championship. So it's one of those things where, you know, today's era, one of the big things is if you're one of the superstars, you kind of glom together, right? Which is why we saw the, you know, Miami Heat team that was so dominant and the Golden State Warriors teams that were, you know, so dominant. You know, and I think that's just the beginning, you know, and I think the LA is starting to kind of assemble a team like that now. And, you know, that we're probably only going to see more of that. That wasn't really what happened so much in that era. And then Carter never really moved in that direction, you know? So I think he had his share of, you know, playoff games where, you know, he was in the playoffs, but I don't think he ever even played in the finals, if I'm not mistaken, or only did, you know, once or twice. So, one of those careers that's kind of distinguished more just by individual accomplishments. And, you know, I think, you know, if you open up that discussion to like top 100 players of all time, I feel like he probably belongs in that discussion. But probably not in like a top 50 discussion, I wouldn't think. But, you know, some basketball expert will probably tweet at us and tell us why I'm wrong. So be it. Come at me. Okay. So, but before we go to our last couple segments here, anything else, any other players you wanted to zero in on or any other moments or teams or anything like that?
No, you know, it's, we could probably spend days talking about individual players, certain ones that we really just, we followed ourselves or that, that just stand out for some reason. But, you know, I kind of taking a few steps back, it was just, you know, and I think you would agree, it was just a different time. It was a different, league, I think, back then, which I would guess our, you know, our parents' generation would probably say the same thing about, you know, the league, you know, in the 80s and the 70s, you know, like the Bird Johnson era and all of that. But again, not that I dislike it now, but I really did like it then. I feel like there was a lot more passing, a lot more driving to the basket back then, and a lot more teamwork. And I don't know. I just, and again, I could be biased because that's kind of what I grew up with. But it was a real special time.
Yeah.
Just the NBA in the 90s. And I will also add, and there's a whole discussion to be had about this, but I kind of also liked its connection to places like McDonald's, and the sponsorship there. I mean, there were movies, there were toys, there were, lots of different connections there. And I really, it just, again, maybe it's just because it reminds me of childhood and we're talking about, the 90s and nostalgia, but again, it was a really great time to be following the sport.
Yeah, we didn't even talk about Space Jam or the Space Jam soundtrack and Basketball Jones and all the other iconic tracks from that. We could easily fill out like a whole a whole separate episode about all of that. But definitely a special time for the game, and I think it represents something pretty special for us in the 90s in a way that I think that they're obviously NBA is still popular. There's still some major stars, still some great players, great teams. I don't know that it's the same for this generation of fan where, the NBA is kind of the thing. Like, I don't know if there's any sport, that was hotter at that time. We happened to catch it kind of just at the right time, I think, to be really into it. So that transitions as well though, to the categories I wanted to get into. So one is a question of, would it work today? And, to give the listeners a peek behind the curtain, in later episodes, we're going to talk about things like movies and, other forms of entertainment, where this is a little bit more natural question, because obviously basketball does still happen today. It still works. Some people would even say that it's better now in, certain regards. But I think that there are some questions that we could ask, in terms of, specific elements of basketball in the 90s. The style of play one is one that came up, already, and I'll say it's interesting because I don't watch nearly as much basketball now. The impression I get is in some ways it's actually a faster paced game now, for better or for worse. So there's a lot less of that, kind of pass it to the big man and have him post up and then, either kick it back out or just try to shoot the jumper over somebody. A lot more three-point shooting and kind of, fast breaks, which – I think a lot of us were, my instinct is still to say that's not fundamentally sound. That's not as good basketball. And yet it's worked for so many teams. Like the Golden State Warriors, built their style off Steph Curry, just like running down the court and shooting a three as soon as he could. And more often than not making it and then winning championships that way. So, it'd be interesting to see. I think that there are some players who would translate really well and maybe even better from the 90s and into the current style of play. There's other kind of like that Knicks team that we both love, from the early 90s that kind of grinded out, Anthony Mason, Charles Oakley team. I don't know that they would do so well in today's in NBA, right? But I've said a lot. Is there anything you want to add to that conversation of kind of, style of player, things that would kind of translate or wouldn't translate now?
No, well, I think the same as you, and that I think a lot of it would not translate well. I mean, there's just a lot of people who are really – a lot of great players who are known for their – posting up in the, like a lot of forwards and centers and things like that, that if there was kind of constant fast break with shooting threes, like those players just are not going to fit into that style as well. I mean, it changes who you have on the court to faster players, to obviously players that are more accurate. And maybe it's just the evolution of the game. But I also think that while it may or may not work, there is I guess that's the, it depends on what the goal is from an entertainment standpoint. Like I might prefer one style of play over the other.
Sure.
I guess from a purely, will this result in this team having more points than this other team? It might have been always the better way to go about it. Maybe you don't ever focus on defense ever. Maybe you only draft people who are amazing shooters and who are very fast, and all they do is gun threes and make them. And maybe the other team also makes a ton of baskets, but they can't they can't offset the fact that your team is just full of really fast, great shooters. So that's an option, but then I wouldn't want to, but I don't like the idea of defense not being a component of the game. You know, so you know, from a balance perspective, I think I prefer it in the old, way. And that worked for the players of that era. So it all kind of jived, but I don't know that, to your point, I don't know that it would all work today.
And there have been some changes around things like hand check defense rules and around, you know, shot clock rules and all that sort of stuff that, you know, they do change the game in some ways, you know, but that's where I do think it's interesting to contemplate. I mean, we'll never know, obviously, but, you know, if you take that, you know, 1995-96 Bulls team and put them up against one of those elite Golden State Warriors teams, I genuinely don't know who wins that, right? Because if you kind of strike the balance on rules and kind of, you know, that's kind of fair for both sides, I think the Golden State has a hard time overcoming, you know, just the sheer, you know, will and desire and scoring ability of Jordan and, you know, and Rodman's ability to get in people's head and, you know, and play defense. But at the same time, I don't know that Bulls team with, like, you know, Luke Longley as their best center really is going to be able to, you know, get up and down the court in time to guard the Golden State Warriors effectively. So,
right.
So anyway, I think it raises interesting questions, though. I think you're right, though, that some of it comes down to aesthetics and we can't really know. But the two other things that just kind of were interesting to me, and I'll you know, speed through these a little bit, because we're kind of going over our planned time, but Michael Jordan's politics, which I don't know how, you know, how much you kind of, you know, read or heard about this, but when he was kind of in his day, when he was kind of, you know, the biggest star in the league, if not the world, he very cagily stayed away from politics. And the most he said, which did kind of tip his hand a little bit, was his famous quote where he said, the reason I don't talk about politics is because Republicans buy sneakers too. Where basically he was kind of tipping his head and saying, like, I don't want to piss off the Republicans who are going to buy my sneakers, but I don't like them. Right. It's kind of what he's getting at in kind of a veiled way. If you contrast that with today's NBA, where, like, LeBron James, I guess, you know, probably the biggest star in the league, he is very open in his kind of, you know, conversations around, you know, Black Lives Matter and his kind of being an opponent to, you know, President Trump and so on and so forth. I don't know that a superstar just kind of trying to stay out of it really plays as well in a 2020 kind of context. So I just sort of think that that's interesting to think about. Like, we just live in sort of a different world around things like that, where I think if you reach a certain level of celebrity, you're expected to take a stand, or else you're going to be criticized for not having an opinion or you know, advocating for your opinion on those sorts of things. Is there anything you want to say on that topic?
Only that I feel like it's, you know, obviously I think it should be the person's choice. And if somebody wants to stay out of politics, you said that, you know, they likely would get criticized for not taking a stance. Mm-hmm. And if they took a stance, they would be criticized by the opposing people. So, you know, it's, one of these damned if you do, damned if you don't. I mean, I can tell you, if I were at that level, I would, I don't know what I would do. I'd imagine there's pressure. When you're at that level and you're that much of an influence on people, you know, just people look up to you, people listen to what you say, you know, I think that it just, there's just a lot of pressure there, and I wouldn't, let's say I don't envy it, but I don't really have much to say other than, you know, in a perfect world, the person would be able to do whatever they feel comfortable with and not be criticized. But unfortunately, that's not the world we live in today.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to bring in a much more contemporary reference here, but, you know, there's a documentary about Taylor Swift on Netflix now. I forget the name of it, but I really like Taylor Swift, for better or for worse. The documentary, they talk about it, because she's, you know, emerged as, you know, what, one of the top, you know, music stars in the world at this point. Her people really, really didn't want her to say anything about politics. And she was kind of, you know, ongoingly torn. And one of the main criticisms people had about her was that she stayed out of politics despite being, you know, so well revered at that point. And she finally did kind of, you know, become more vocal, and, you know, now that's kind of part of her persona, is she is pretty outspoken about things in that platform. I guess to me, the thing is, if you're that famous, you kind of have some level of responsibility almost if you think something's, you know, unjust or, you know, needs to go a certain way. You know, I'm not just talking about kind of, you know, more arbitrary elements of politics, but, you know, more kind of things that people would have placed some, you know, moral values to kind of have a stand. But by the same token, I do hear what you're saying. I do think there's some point at which you can't have a full educated, you know, strong opinion about everything. Right. If I can't comment on what's going on in Rwanda right now, some of that's my ignorance, sure. But like, I also can't keep up on literally everything that's going on everywhere in the world, you know, at any given moment. So anyway, on a more fun note, in terms of, you know, how has it aged or, you know, would it work today? Man, I wish Dennis Rodman had been on Twitter during his heyday. I bet we would have gotten some crazy pictures on Twitter or Instagram or, you know, whatever it would have been. Because that guy has such a legend built around him of being so absurd, right? We're probably going to dedicate a future episode to talking about 90s wrestling, which is, you know, so close to my heart. He would skip NBA, you know, official Bulls practices to show up on WCW Nitro. That guy was just nuts, right? I could just imagine, you know, some, you know, Bulls executive getting the call from Phil Jackson, like, yeah, Rodman didn't show up for practice, and then looking on Instagram and seeing a picture of him with Hulk Hogan, and how ridiculous that could have been. And man, I wish we could have seen that. Any of that or any other thoughts you want to get into there?
Well, I mean, we don't have to get far into it, but you know, that's the thing. I mean, basketball is entertainment, right? And yeah. Sports are entertainment. He himself is a form of entertainment, and he, you know, there's a saying, zero F's given, right? Yeah. And he lived it. And I think a lot of people respected that, you know, like there was a Bulls game where I think, I forgot what game it was, but he went out and he ran out to the 3-point line. I think the game was getting towards the close, and he drained a three. Then they got the ball the next possession. He drained another three. This is a rebounder that usually does not shoot three pointers. Right. And he then gets the ball a third time, drains it again. And the crowd is going nuts because I think he had shot like maybe like one or two other threes the entire season or something. And here he is in one game, just draining three after three. Cause he's crazy. He's right. Crazy. To me, he's like the Howard Stern of the NBA. You know, he kind of said, I'm going to do what I want to do. And that's the thing. He got famous enough. He got a following enough that I feel like people got, you know, like the executives. I mean, I don't know if he ever got like seriously fined or reprimanded, but like, I feel like they kind of embraced it after a while because people would come to the games to see Rodman. Yeah. I agree. I wish he had Twitter then. I sure he had it. Would have had a. I would have followed him. Put it that way. And a lot of people would have followed him. So yeah. I mean, he's just an interesting character.
Stands out. No, and you know, and I wonder though if that level of eccentricity, because he's kind of faded, right? Because he, you know, when you think about how big he was in the late '90s, to now not really have much of a celebrity presence, we haven't seen The Last Dance yet, so maybe they get into it a little bit there, but, you know, I know he's had his dealings with North Korea, which are so unusual and questionable in terms of his morals, but, like, it's interesting, and it makes me wonder if some of that's his choice or how much of that is, that people just don't want to play ball with him anymore, because it's like, no, we just have no idea what he's going to do, so we're just having to do business with him. I don't know, but I could see either of those in case. Let's go to our last real segment here. We're doing a thing called, at least for now, I'm calling it the draft. So it makes a lot of sense for basketball. It may make a little bit less sense for some of our future episode topics. But we've drawn up kind of a selection of, the top players of the NBA in the 90s. I went to this feature that I think it was NBA.com itself put out, where they just kind of had ranked the top like 30 some odd people at each position. And I narrowed it down to like the top 5 to 10 or guys I thought realistically we'd be interested in. And we each have a list that we're looking at here, kind of a bank of players to pull together our ideal team. If we were, you know, the general manager, we were charged with drafting the starting lineup. So one player from each of the major positions, just kind of, you know, who we would pick to fill out those five roster spots. So we'll take turns picking. I'm kind of arbitrarily putting the rule out here that we'll take only about 30 seconds per pick. So just so this won't drag on for too long and, you know, bore our listeners. Option to discuss if you want to, you know, your rationale for why you're picking that player. Option just kind of just let it sit, and, you know, some of it might be kind of self-explanatory. But you know, just to kind of have some fun, just kind of review some of the best players, maybe talk about a few names we haven't really addressed very much on the show yet, and see what we come up with. But the way I'm going to put this, and feel free to disagree with me, Mike, and we can kind of talk this out in real time here. I'm going to say, so when we look at these players, these are all players who played in the 90s, but you can kind of take any version of them. So for example, some of the players on the board here, like Charles Barkley, for example, I think that, you know, you can say if you have, you know, 1993 Charles Barkley, he's one of the best in the league, if not the best in the league at that point. You take 1999 Charles Barkley, he's still a good player, but he's not in that conversation of being, you know, kind of elite anymore. So it's whatever version. And similarly, some of these guys, you know, peaked, you know, afterwards, like Tim Duncan is on the board here. I think undeniably was better in the 2000s than he was in the 90s. But you can take the 2000s version of him if you so choose. So you're kind of the best of these players' respective careers. And there's a few who are better in the 80s than in the 90s. So just so we don't get too bogged down. And, well, he wasn't that good at that point in his career. So that could become its own kind of, you know, side thing. But with that, why don't we go ahead and draft some players? So in my magnanimity, is that how that's pronounced? I don't know. But in being generous here, I'm going to go ahead and
allow it.
All right, I'm going to give you the first pick here in exchange for that. So we're both looking at the same set of players on the board. And if you think of other players who aren't on the board, feel free to pull them into the conversation. I'll call you on it if they never played in the 90s. But otherwise, kind of everyone is fair game. So go ahead, take the first pick.
Oh, God. I have to go with David Robinson.
Ooh, interesting.
Yeah. I mean, well, so I'm making a first pick. So I'm going by position. And I'm starting with centers.
Yeah.
And I would go with David Robinson. I just think he was a solid player. And partly, you know, I respect him too. I mean, he waited to come into the NBA until he finished his education. And I think he was just a solid player throughout his career. And it wasn't one of these, again, I love John Starks, but John Starks types were like, you know, it could be really good one day and then really horrible, you know, really not good the next day. So, so that's why I picked David Robinson. I think he's a solid player that's consistent and just one you can count on.
Yeah, he was really steady, I'm glad he finally got his championship. You know, ultimately, mm-hmm. he never won it when he was kind of the man on the team. Although I think he came close to the finals a few times, but, Tim Duncan kind of pushed him over. But yeah, I think that's a sound pick. I get that. I'm going to be a little bit less diplomatic. I'm just going to go for Michael Jordan out of the gate then with my number two pick. I think just in terms of, you know, guys who are going to win championships, there's just no one who I kind of put on the same level as MJ. So not the best citizen. He might just spontaneously retire on me after a season or two. But if I've got him at his best and he's motivated, I can't think anyone better. So I'm going to go with Jordan for pick number two here.
I like how you said he might retire, and my guy will still be in the league at least.
You know? That's true. You'll probably win more championships, but I'll get one sooner is my rationale.
That's true. Well, so but the beauty of both of those picks. So Robinson gets the championship because they beat the Knicks, right?
Yeah.
Right. And you pick Jordan, who I think after coming back from retirement, I'm fairly certain, I think when they played, I think it was the Bulls versus the Knicks at Madison Square Garden, I think he scores 55 points.
Yeah. There was a game. Yeah. He was 95 and he'd just come back from baseball. And one of his first few games back, he stomps the Knicks.
Yeah.
So
it's like good feeling. Both against the Knicks. Great. Yeah. So anyway, is it that I can't pick? So now I can't pick.
Yeah. So David Robinson, Michael Jordan are off the board. Everyone else is.
Okay. Okay, so you're welcome for not picking Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
So I guess I gotta go with. I have to go with Magic Johnson.
Full transparency, that would be my next pick too. So I get you.
Yeah, I can't. You can't argue the the versatility again. I keep saying that, but play any position, and play any position really well. So, leave it at that.
And a great teammate too, right? He's one of those all time. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, he could score, and he has a lot of games where he, you know, broke 30, broke 40. But he also had games where he didn't break 10, and but was just killing it on assists, killing it on defense, and you know, just kind of making it happen for his teammates. So, yeah, I think he's a great pick. Shoot, I was going to go with him. I'm going to stick on kind of my ultimate competitors thread here, because this is kind of the avenue that I'm going down. So, in small forward, I'm going to pick Larry Bird. I think that's similar to Jordan. He's one of those guys who just hated losing, love winning, was a constant competitor. You know, and I think, you know, despite on paper being a not particularly fast, you know, white dude who, you know, shouldn't have been able to hang with all these guys in the NBA, still got it done. So I'm picking Larry Bird with that next pick there.
Okay. Fair enough. Then I have to go with Scottie Pippen.
Oh, all right.
Scottie Pippen. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we already talked about him early in the episode, but I mean, he's cheap, you know, only $2 million relative to your Jordan $30 million. Are we not taking finances into play? Just, you know, part of a great team. You know, I think a great teammate, great player. I got to go with Scotty.
Yeah, that's a great pick. All right, so. Yeah, you know, I'm kind of breaking my own form here because I was kind of going for like these guys are going to go for the jugular and, you know, won't allow themselves to lose. I'm going to mix up a little bit here because I have two guys who are undeniable scorers at this point. And so I feel like we need to fill in some other blanks on my roster. At the point guard, I'm going to pick the all-time great assist man, John Stockton. You know, I think that there are probably better players on the board still and then better point guards even in terms of all around play. But in terms of just kind of filling that role, there's a reason he's the all-time assist leader, right? He just handled the ball so well, passed so well, so unselfish. And he could shoot. He was a scorer. He could play defense. But first and foremost, he would get the ball in other people's hands. And so if you have Michael Jordan and Larry Bird on that team already, you need somebody who's going to pass it to them, right? So I'm going to go with John Stockton, a point guard, with the number 6 pick in our draft
here. Oh, that's interesting. And a great pick, by the way. I mean, Stockton is, yeah. So I guess for shooting guards, I can't with any kind of, I can't bring myself to pick Reggie Miller, even though I actually think that he's in the conversation, and his conversion rate is really good. And he's a great free throw shooter and all of that. But I just, given his history with the Knicks, I can't do it. I'd rather have a semi-losing team or something. I don't know, or not as good of a team. But I will probably pick. I'll go with my man Allen Houston.
All right.
Allen Houston again. You know, one of my favorite Knicks. Number 20, just really, really solid player. I mean, again, there's some, you know, it's open for debate a little bit, but he's always been a pretty solid pick in my book, so I'll have him on my team.
All right, I like it. So we're down to the kind of degree. This is our final three in the draft. I still have center and power forward open. I need my big man here. You've just got power forward, so. I'm going to go with this strategically because I think there are some better centers on the board, but in anticipation that I've got to secure my power forward now, and I want to make sure I get somebody I want. We're both gunning for that spot. There are some great choices. Just to give people a sense of the names here, because I think I'm going to surprise the other Mike here, because the names that we have on the board here, Kevin Garnett, Chris Webber, Dennis Rodman, Sean Kemp, Tim Duncan, Charles Barkley, and Karl Malone. There's no bad pick there, right?
There isn't.
There's a few who I would kind of remove from like kind of my top few, but nonetheless, I think you can obviously, you know, have a good at least three or four guys who are very much in this conversation. But I think I'm going to surprise Mike here with who I'm going to go with in this conversation. I'm going to go with Kevin Garnett. Again, this is
kind of, whoa.
Sorry. So applying the logic that these are players who might not have been at their peak in the 90s. I think he definitely, you know, was still, he came straight out of high school and, you know, debuted, I think, in 95 or 96. And, you know, I think it took a few years to really hit his stride. But, you know, was really good for the Timberwolves in those early years. And they got a chance to go to the Celtics and start winning championships. And my favorite story about Garnett is he had this thing where when he went to the Celtics, a part of his identity was he would try to be the first guy to help his teammates get up off the floor when they got knocked down, which is just a random kind of weird thing, but embodied kind of the team spirit that he was trying to kind of engender as the leader of that team, where it'd be, you know, we're all in this together. Sure, I might score the most, or Paul Pierce might score the most, but I'm going to be the first one to help my teammate get up. Right. Which is just as a leader on a team, it's kind of almost the antithesis of a Michael Jordan. Right. So I've already got Jordan there who's going to, you know, ride guys down. I'm going to have Garnett to pick him back up, and also just be a great versatile player. Because again, he, you know, kind of was best known in either that small forward or power forward kind of role. But he was big enough. He could have played center. He could shoot the ball reasonably well, could play one of those guard spots. So I'll go ahead and plug him in with the number 8 pick.
Yeah, and that's a great way to – that's a great rationale behind that. I mean, all those things you said. And it is a little surprising given the list of names here, but at the same time, he's also a great player. So, I mean, on that level, it's like you can't really go wrong with any of these names. So,
yeah.
So I get it. I get it. Except maybe Chris Webber. You could go a little bit wrong with Chris Webber. But
him or Sean Kemp were the kind of the outliers on this list.
Sean
wouldn't have gone with, but anyone else I think was a fair pick at that point.
That's true. And actually, so this one's tough for me because I really like Tim Duncan a lot. Yeah. And I part of the reason this is going to sound stupid, part of the reason I really like Tim Duncan, and I'm not saying I'm choosing him, but part of the reason that it makes it a tough choice is because I really like Tim Duncan. I think he's I like that he uses he leverages the backboard a lot. Mm-hmm. And I feel like when you use the backboard to your advantage, you increase your conversion a lot, you know, it's just mm-hmm. really, and he's not afraid to do that. Just one thing I've always liked about him, mm-hmm. but I think I'm going to go with, Charles Barkley.
I mean,
drafted by the 76ers, right? Played a lot of his career in Phoenix, but whenever I see him play, I mean, I think he's a good all around player. I mean, all the things that a lot of the players are, you know, he's a good, he's a pretty good shooter, dunker, whatever. But his will, you know, I mean, he mm-hmm. just had a no BS attitude. Like, I'm going to do whatever it takes to get the ball and to get it in that hoop, you know? Yeah. And so, so I really like his attitude and his desire, you know, and, you know, sometimes mind over matter, right? Like the Rudy's of the bunch, right? I mean, not quite to that level, but that kind of thing, you know, Jordan knows he's the best, you know, and he is really good. But other people have to work a little bit hard for it. Sometimes you want those people on your team, and I feel like Barkley is somebody who's kind of had to work for it a little bit.
Yeah, no. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I think if we're going to talk about just kind of where desire gets someone, I would probably rate Barkley only behind Jordan in that conversation. Cause Jordan, I just sort of feel like, again, he had the natural athleticism and ability too, but just, I think when he got mad or when he got kind of incentivized one way or another, like he just would not be denied. I think you're right. Just in terms of, you know, physical gifts, I think he was only 6'6". So like, you know, that's obviously objectively a big person, but for a power forward in the NBA, that's not super, you know, tall. But just in terms of hustle, in terms of just wanting it more, was always, you know, inserting himself in the discussion that way. I think that's a great pick. I think to be honest, I think it'd be either him or Duncan for me. I think that's a real tough choice between the two. So I don't think there's a wrong way to go. But for our final pick here, I've been torn. I've been thinking about this, you know, since earlier on in the draft, because once you picked David Robinson first, To me, Robinson and Olajuwon are the two best centers of the 90s. So I would pick one of them or the other. I actually might give a slight edge to Olajuwon, but it's arbitrary at that point. I think you make an argument in either direction there. And then you got Patrick Ewing, who was in many ways my favorite player of the 90s. He's a Knick, so I feel kind of heartbroken to not have a Knick on my roster here. Despite this equivocation and these excuses I'm giving here, I'm going to go with Shaq for my last pick here at center.
There's the surprising one to me.
Partly in the vein that I sort of feel like, had he worked as hard as he could have, Bill Simmons, who I think we both kind of enjoy as a commentator and as a writer, he has a whole shtick about Shaq where he relates it to himself as a college student, where he's like, if I'd really focused in college, I probably could have had like a 3.8, 3.9, maybe even a 4.0. I didn't, so I had like a 3.2. Is what Bill Simmons, and I'm just, you know, pulling these numbers very, very roughly. And he kind of relates himself to Shaq in that way, where it's like, given his physical abilities, if he had, you know, worked out hard, focused on his game, you know, stayed in shape over the off season, he might be in that discussion with, you know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and, you know, guys like that. It was like, you know, one of the great centers of all time. Because he kind of phoned it in and was just kind of a monster physically who could do whatever he wanted. He didn't have to work hard. He had Kobe Bryant next to him for, you know, his championship year. So it was like, okay, cool. He's going to work hard. So I can just be, you know, one of the best centers. I don't have to worry about being the best center. If he could get motivated though, I think he could have been in that discussion and, you know, could have been at the top of this list. Couldn't shoot free throws, but I've already got John Stockton, Larry Bird, Michael Jordan on my roster. So we're going to be okay in that regard. I'm going to put him on the floor as our fifth guy. It's kind of the physical monster. Maybe Jordan can get him motivated. And if not, he's still kind of, you know, got that star presence that we're going to be drawing kind of casual fans to the arena and sell some tickets. You know, he'll do just fine, in that regard. So to go for our final rosters, though, you've got David Robinson, Magic Johnson, Allen Houston, Scottie Pippen, and Charles Barkley. I've got Shaq. I've got John Stockton. I've got Michael Jordan, Larry Bird, and Kevin Garnett. I don't know who wins that game, right? It probably depends on who we've got on the bench after that. And so we're not going to subject our listeners to the full draft of our 12-man rosters, but I think we're off to a pretty good start here in both of these starting lineups. Lined up one up against the other. So with that, any last thoughts on the draft, on NBA basketball in the 90s, anything along those lines, my friend?
No, the only thing I'll say, I mean, I said it before, it's that it was a special time. And I feel like, even though most of the time was spent between you and me and a few of our friends, I like to think that it was similar for a lot of the listeners here that grew up in the 90s. Like they understand kind of how it was and how big of a thing it was and how, you know, growing up, the players had such an influence on us. So at least I like to hope that they kind of felt that way.
Yeah. No, well said. Yeah. So, Well, with that, I want to thank everyone who's taking the time to listen to us. We had some fun talking about all this and recording this. And we're going to plan to be back, you know, before too long with our second episode. It's in the works. I'm going to leave it a surprise for now what that episode is going to be. But I think, again, our fellow people who kind of grew up in the 90s, have some attachment to the 90s, are going to enjoy it. So thanks to our listeners. Thanks to our friend Mike Peake for the theme music for this show. And for all of you out there, please be kind. Rewind. We'll catch you next time.